People were walking past her around the baby as if they were invisible. I could not ignore her. I put a 101 note on the baby's lap. I thought it was hopeless to give it to the mother. Her eyes were clouded and not focusing. She wasn't seeing me. I guess she was close to death. The money would have bought food for a couple of days. I rescued a baby today, I told my mother when I got home. I thought she would be proud to know that I had cared while others had walked by. What do you mean? I told her what I had done. She dropped what she was doing and turned to me, highly annoyed. Are you completely stupid? How can a baby buy anything? Some thief will have snatched that note straight off him. You should have just bought food for them. She was right, and I felt responsible. After that, I started thinking a lot about charity. Sharing what we had made us good communists, but at the same time it seemed futile. People had so little and had to take care of their own families first. I could spare the 101 note I'd given to the baby and his mother, but I realized it would have solved their problem only for a couple of days. This thought depressed me utterly. A shadow began to fall across Haesan. Beggars were appearing everywhere, especially around the markets. This was a sight I'd never seen in our country before. There were vagrant children, too. At first, only in twos or threes, but soon many of them, migrating to Haesan from the countryside. Their parents had perished of hunger, leaving them to fend for themselves without relatives. They were nicknamed Kuchebi, flowering swallows. And, like birds, they seemed to gather in flocks. One of their survival tricks was to distract a market vendor while accomplices snatched the food and ran off. In a horrible twist of irony, they were regularly seen scavenging in the dirt for grains, peel or gristle. Exactly how we'd been told the children in South Korea lived. At school, children whose parents were struggling to feed them came less regularly, and then stopped coming altogether. My class size shrank in size by a third. Some of the teachers stopped coming too. They were making a living as market traders instead. Food was not the only thing in short supply. There was no fertilizer for crops. In the villages, children had to bring a quota of their own excrement to school for use as fertilizer. Families locked their outhouses in case thieves stole what little they had. There was no fuel. The steel and lumber mills fell idle. Factory chimneys stopped puffing smoke, and the city streets fell silent and empty during the day. The larches and pines that made the foothills of the mountains so beautiful began to disappear. The landscape was being denuded of trees. People were foraging for fuel as a freezing wind swept down from Manchuria with the onset of winter. Power cuts became more frequent, to the point where the electricity hardly came on at all. To light our home in the evening, my mother made a lamp from a pot of diesel, with a strip of cotton as a wick. This gave off such a dirty smoke that Mino and I would have a circle of soot around our mouths. One cold morning early in winter, a few weeks before the river froze, I took a walk in the sunshine along the riverside path and saw what looked like a rag gliding in the slow current. Then I saw that the rag had an upturned human face. The eyes were open. I watched in horror as it passed, heading downriver past my house. Just before dawn, before people on the Chinese bank would notice, the border guards had been retrieving corpses from the water and covering them with straw. They were people who had tried to cross somewhere upriver and were too weak to make it. The current could be fast after it had rained in the mountains. In early 1996, not long after my 16th birthday, I saw a crowd gathered around a middle-aged man at a market outside the city. He was giving a speech, speaking with a Korean-Chinese accent. He had a pot belly and a good-quality padded coat. He looked well off. I guessed he had come from China for the day to visit relatives. "Why has this suffering fallen upon our people?" he said. Tears were rolling down his plump cheeks. "People are starving and dying. How could this happen to our country?" He reached into his breast pocket and took out a wad of blue Chinese 10 yuan notes. An instant tension ran through the crowd. He began handing the notes out to everyone and anyone. As if summoned by a whistle, beggars in rags materialized from everywhere, holding out their hands. The man was surrounded in every direction by outstretched arms. He gave away all his notes. His question stuck in my mind. What exactly was happening? There had been no war. In fact, everyone had forgotten all about the nuclear strike for which we'd spent so much time digging and practicing air raid drills. Famine had appeared out of nowhere like a plague. The official explanation for the arduous march, as the propaganda obliquely called the famine, was the Yankee-backed UN economic sanctions, coupled with crop failures and freak flooding that had made the situation worse. When I heard this, I believed that Kim Jong-il was doing his very best for us in terrible circumstances. What would the people do without him? The true reason, which I did not learn until years later, and which was known to very few people in North Korea, had more to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the refusal of the new Russian government to continue subsidizing us with fuel and food. Kim Jong-il was now in charge of the country. We listened to a television news anchor quavering with emotion as she described how our dear leader was eating only simple meals of rice balls and potatoes in sympathy with the people suffering. But on the screen he looked as portly and well-fed as ever. As a distraction from the economy, which seemed not to be functioning at all, news reports showed him endlessly inspecting the nation's defences and army bases. A war for unification with the South would solve everything, people were saying. I could tell from their accents that a lot of the beggars in the city were not from Haesan. They had come from North Hamgyong and South Hamgyong provinces. We'd heard that the situation there was very bad. I did not realise how bad until I made a visit to Aunt Pretty in Hamhung that spring of 1996. It was a journey through the landscape of hell. Spring is the leanest season in North Korea, when food stocks from the previous harvest are exhausted and the year's crops have not yet grown. The land was bare and brown. It looked blighted, cursed. On every hill, trees had been felled, and for miles around, individual people dotted the open countryside, roaming listlessly like living dead, foraging for food, aimless. Or they sat on their haunches along the side of the track, doing nothing, waiting for nothing. Before the famine, no one could make a journey without a travel permit stamped in their ID passbook, which was scanned by inspectors at the train station. Now, there were no controls. Order was breaking down everywhere. Soldiers turned thieves. Police became muggers. The trains ran to no timetable. At each stop, there were hundreds more passengers than seats, and the journey became terrifying. At one stop, I narrowly avoided being hit by shards of smashed glass as people broke a carriage window to climb straight in and avoid the bottleneck at the doors. The carriage was dangerously packed. Workless, hungry people were travelling in the hope of selling something for food. The crowds became so thick and tight that when we finally reached Hamhung, I had to climb over people to get to the door. On the platform, I looked back and saw there were hundreds of people on the roof of the carriage. People smuggling goods to sell chose to sit on the roof. No official would risk his life going up there to inspect. At around this time, my mother, on a journey of her own to Wonsan to visit Uncle's cinema, saw a policeman order an old woman down. Her clothing was bulging with some contraband she was hoping to sell. The police were always alert for smuggled goods that they could confiscate for themselves and sell.
"Please don't search me,"
she was begging him from the top of the train.
"It's all I have."
"Get down right now, you old bitch," the policeman yelled.
The woman asked to be helped down. The policeman reached up to help her. As she took his hand, her free arm shot up and her fist closed over the electrified wire above the train. Both were killed instantly. She must have thought, "If I'm going, I'm taking this bastard with me." As I entered the city, I thought my memory was playing tricks. The Hamhung where I'd lived as a girl was a buzzing industrial hub, with so many factory chimneys gushing smoke that the air sometimes choked us. But now it was fresh and clear. That great polluting monster, the Hungnam ammonium fertilizer plant, was no longer turning the sky yellow with chemicals. There were almost no trolley buses or cars, no bustle on the sidewalks, just people wandering lethargically or talking to themselves, hallucinating from hunger. Aunt Pretty had been making money importing Chinese clothes from Haisan to Hamhung and sending back seafood from the coast, but now she was casting about for a new venture as the transport situation became dire. She thought the authorities had taken the decision to cut off the public distribution system altogether in North Hamgyong province in order to save the rest of the country. I asked why that province.
Because it has so many people of the lowest Songbun, she said.
People were falling dead in the streets. Starvation and necessity, however, were forcing a radical change of mindset. I saw it for myself in Hamhung. People were unlearning lifetimes of ideology and reverting to what humans have practiced for thousands of years. Trade. Black markets, where food was on sale at high free market prices, were springing up everywhere. At roadsides, in train stations, in mothballed industrial plants. And the new rising class of entrepreneurs was overwhelmingly female and of low Songbun. Very soon a person's Songbun became far less important than their ability to make money and obtain food. Many women laid their wares on mats along the sidewalk, keeping alert for thieves and kachebi. But some markets had already developed into more permanent-looking sites, with stalls and awnings fashioned from blue burlap rice sacks of the UN World Food Programme. Incredible as it seemed for a city in the grip of a deathly famine, there were opportunities for social advancement and business success for those who had an eye for a chance. During this visit, I heard someone say, "There are those who starve, those who beg, and those who trade." Coming from Haisan, I knew many commercially minded people, but in Hamhung, North Korea's second biggest city, such attitudes seemed new. The journey back to Haisan was as nightmarish as the journey out. Many people were riding in the undercarriage, or clinging to the outside of the train, or sitting on the roof beneath the electrified wires. When I arrived at Haisan station, a man was lying on the platform with the top of his head so badly smashed that part of his brain was exposed. He was still alive, asking in a quavering voice whether he was going to be all right. He died a few moments later. He had been riding in the undercarriage and had been hit by the edge of the platform as the train came into the station. During the famine, such accidents became common. That year, 1996, the culture of our country changed noticeably. In the past, when visiting someone's home, I'd be welcomed by the greeting, "Have you had rice?" This was a gesture of hospitality, meaning, "Have you eaten? Join us." But with the food shortages, how could anyone give the old greeting with sincerity? It wasn't long before it was replaced by, "You've eaten, haven't you?" Many were too embarrassed or proud to admit they were starving and wouldn't take food even when it was offered. When Minot's young accordion teacher started coming to the house, my mother would ask if he'd like lunch. She could afford to maintain the old etiquette. "I've eaten, thank you," he would say, politely bowing his head. "But a bowl of water with some doenjang would be nice." My mother obliged, but thought this odd. Nobody drank water with the soybean paste used to flavour soup. Each time, the teacher gulped it down in seconds. After a month of lessons, he stopped coming. My mother heard he had starved to death. She was stunned. Why hadn't he accepted her offers of food? He'd valued his dignity more than his own life. One afternoon that summer, Minot and I came home after school to find a thief in the house. He was a scrawny soldier with pitted skin, no older than about 19. He was trying to carry the Toshiba television set, but his arms weren't strong enough. Soldiers had been robbing houses all over Haisan, and they were usually turned over to the police. But my mother just gave him some money and told him to buy food. As the famine deepened, rumours of cannibalism spread throughout the province. The government issued stark warnings about it. We heard that an elderly man had killed a child and put the cooked meat into soup. He sold it at a market canteen, where it was eaten by eager diners. The crime was discovered when police found the bones. I thought these killers must have been psychopaths, and that ordinary people would never resort to such crimes. Now I am not so sure. Having spoken to many who came close to death during that time, I realise that starvation can drive people to insanity. It can cause parents to take food from their own children, people to eat the corpses of the dead, and the gentlest neighbour to commit murder. Across the country, the travel permit system had collapsed, but entry into Pyongyang was still tightly controlled. That summer, I received permission to visit Uncle Money and his wife. It was my second long train journey in the worst imaginable year to travel. I was nervous about the visit. In fact, I was braced for scenes similar to those I'd seen in Hamhung. But to my great surprise, all was normal in the capital of the revolution. Well-fed people were going about their business, the vast boulevards had electrified streetcars, and traffic. I saw no beggars or hordes of vagrant children. The power stations were puffing smoke. The loyal class who lived here seemed insulated from what was happening in the rest of the country. After I'd laid flowers and bowed at the feet of the bronze colossus of Kim Il-sung on Mansu Hill, so large it made me feel like an ant, my uncle and aunt took me out to Omanyu Guan, the most famous noodle restaurant in the country. The place was packed out, with people waiting for a table. Clearly no one was going hungry. My uncle had power and influence. We went straight to the front of the line and were admitted without having to wait. Uncle Money was a large man with a large personality, which seemed fitting to his position as the wealthiest member of the family. His house had its own sauna. I've never seen such a luxury in my life. I counted 5 televisions. Some were still in the boxes, to give as bribes. At dinner in his dining room one evening, I was served Western food for the first time. Some kind of pasta dish. It didn't look like real food. Uncle Money laughed at the expression on my face.
Most people will never have a chance to eat this in their lives. If you don't try it now, maybe you never will.
Uncle Money's wife wore such fashionable clothes, she did not look North Korean. She was a manager at department store number 1 in Pyongyang, which was regularly featured on the television news, showing shelves laden with colourful produce. But when I visited her there, she told me that the goods on the shelves were for display only, to impress foreign visitors. The store had no stock to replace what was sold. I told her I'd hoped to buy a present for my mother, like the small makeup set I'd seen beneath a glass counter. My aunt winked at the shop assistant, who took it out and gave it to me. As I travelled back to Haesan, I thought the whole visit had seemed like a strange dream. I could not believe Pyongyang was in the same country where people were dying on the sidewalks in a Hamhung, and vagrant children swarmed in the markets of Haesan. In the end, though, not even Pyongyang stayed immune. The regime could not prevent famine coming to the heart of its own power base. Chapter 17. The Lights of Changbai. The boy shouted his answer.
I want to be a tank driver.
Our teacher beamed approvingly.
And why do you want to be a tank driver?
To defend our country from the Yankee bastards.
The boy sat back down. It was my final year at secondary school, and we were each being asked about our careers. Like all obedient socialist youth, we were telling the teacher what she wanted to hear. When we'd been taught for as long as we could remember about how the respected father leader had dedicated his entire life to the people's cause, and how great a burden he had shouldered to keep our country safe from its enemies, even a kindergarten kid would have known it would not have pleased the teacher if I'd put my hand up and said, I want to be a pop star. You would expect between school friends a more honest conversation about our hopes for the future and what we wanted to do with our lives, and that did happen to an extent. But by the time we were ready to graduate, we had learned to trim our expectations in line with our songbun. Our choices fell within a certain range. In my class, the few of us with good songbun either took the university entrance exam or, if they were boys, went straight to military service. A few were able, through family connections, to land good jobs with the police or the Puibu. More than half the students in my class were in the Songbun hostile category. A list of their names was sent to a government office in Haesan, where officials assigned them to mines and farms. One girl from this group took the test to enter university and passed, but was not permitted to go. My good Songbun meant I could plan. My dreams were private and modest. I wanted to be an accordionist. It's a popular instrument in North Korea, and a woman who can play it well had no difficulty making a living. That would be my official career, but like my mother, I also wanted to trade, start an illicit business, and make money. I thought this would be exciting. I also knew that it would be the only way to ensure that my own family, when one day I had children of my own, would have enough to eat. My mother fully supported the accordion career choice and found a musician from the theatre in Haesan to give me tuition. She said my father would have been pleased, as he'd always enjoyed accordion music. This made me cry. I was 17 years old. In just a few months, in January 1998, I would turn 18. This thought weighed heavy. At 18, we were adult citizens and received our official ID passbooks. The pranks and misdemeanors that children could get away with became serious crimes once we turned 18. And there was one prank I was increasingly tempted to commit before it was too late. In the winter of 1997, a school friend who lived near our house asked if I'd like to slip across the river with her to the border country of Changbai in China. Her mother, like mine, had trading contacts there. She had already crossed a few times, so she knew what she was doing. The idea thrilled me. My plan after the winter vacation was to try for a place at Haesan Economic School, which ran two-year courses. It was harder to get into than a four-year university course. Graduates were expected to work for state-run companies, of course, not in illegal private trade. Grades didn't matter much. Money and influence were what counted. I wanted to study there and start a business trading in imported goods. So why not take a sneak look at Changbai? Changbai, to me, represented business. By then, Mino had crossed illegally many times. Young boys often did. He wanted to play with the Chinese boys on the other side. Sometimes, when the guards weren't looking, he'd slip across to visit Mr. Ahn and his wife, or Mr. Chang, my mother's trading contacts, whose homes were nearby. If he could do it, why couldn't I? From my house, I marveled at the halogen lights and neon signs of Changbai across the river, which never suffered power cuts. At school, the teachers had always told us that the Chinese were envious of us and worse off than we were. I had believed this for years, even though evidence to the contrary was everywhere before my eyes, from the abundant Chinese products on sale in our market to the fashionable Chinese business people walking about Haesan. In the end, it was something Aunt Pretty said that made a light come on in my head. She told me that hungry people headed to Haesan because there was always more food at border towns. Food from China. Did the Chinese have more food? During the famine, Haesan was in darkness every evening, but the clouds over Changbai glowed sodium amber from so many city lights. I started noticing that not one of the Chinese people I saw, not the border guards on the other side, who looked awesome in their green uniforms, or the children playing in the river, looked thin or hungry. They were clearly doing better, much better than we were. This realization began to dislodge one of my longest-held core beliefs, that our country was the best in the world. I had no spoken Mandarin at all, but I knew enough Chinese characters to make sense of some of the subtitles when television programs had them. I had been watching illegal Chinese programs for a few years now, but even when I couldn't understand, I was still fascinated. South Korean pop stars regularly appeared on Chinese TV. Acts like So Taeji and the Boys, an H.O.T., a hugely popular boy band, performed before audiences of screaming girls. I'd never seen anything like them. I could understand the Korean, but I didn't know what on earth they were singing or rapping about. Their fashion, hair, and dance moves made them seem like aliens to me, too weird to be interesting. I was more intrigued by the Chinese TV dramas. Every character seemed to live in a beautifully furnished home, complete with housekeepers and drivers, and kitchens filled with such luxuries as microwaves and washing machines. My mother washed our clothes in the river. Do the Chinese really live like this? I became more and more curious. My friend was anxious to cross over with me as soon as possible. The river was frozen solid. Naively, I expected my mother to give her consent. She always encouraged me in everything I did. But when I asked her, she became very stern. Absolutely not! I was put out. No one will know. Do not ever, ever cross the river, she said. It's a serious crime. Minot goes. He's too young to be punished. Anyway, he's a boy, and a boy needs to learn how to stand on his own two feet. You're a woman now. You'll be 18 next month. My spirit sank. I must have been the only teenager in the world who didn't want to be 18. I'm not 18 yet. My mother told me that made no difference. Women had to be more careful than men in their attitude to everything in life. There was no persuading her about this. She said only starving parents would agree to let a daughter go to China. I had no reason or excuse to do something so dangerous. Well, one day I'm going, I said, trying to have the last word. You will not, she said, almost in a shout. Don't you ever leave our country. Do you understand? As if to mollify me, a day or two later she came home with a very stylish pair of shoes for me. I could have bought 70 kilos of rice for what I paid for those, she said. She so wanted me to be gracious and grateful, but could not help spoiling me. I understood why she was refusing me, but I couldn't stop longing to go. I wanted to see something of the world, and for me, China was the world. Most of all, I wanted to see if what I had been watching on television was real. Lying on my mat, I thought about that time all those years ago in Anju, when I'd run out into a thunderstorm to wait for the terrifying lady in black to come down with the rain. I thought of the day I pushed my way through that crowd beneath the bridge to see something a 7-year-old girl should never have seen, a man hanging by the neck. My curiosity had always been greater than my fear, not a good trait to have in North Korea, where fear keeps your senses sharp and helps you stay alive. Part of me knew very well that crossing into China was highly risky. It could have serious consequences, and not just for me. But I was still 17, and in a few months, I would be starting college. After that, there would not be another chance. Now was the perfect time. Chapter 18. Over the Ice. The Yalu River in front of our house was just 11 yards wide and not deep, waist-height for an adult in the middle. Before people started fleeing North Korea during the famine, the border wasn't strictly controlled. By my late teens, however, it had become heavily guarded. River life had all but disappeared. Any activity along the bank invited intense suspicion. The kids now played elsewhere. Border guards had started closely watching the women who climbed down the bank to fetch water and wash clothes, in case they were receiving contraband or waiting for a moment to cross. By that time, the women who actually were trading had come to discreet understandings with the guards and were paying them off. The river ran more quietly than before, as if it were depressed by its role as a prison fence. Not long after we had moved to the river, the guard whose beat it was along the 50 yards outside our house came to befriend us. He would regularly drop by for a chat and my mother would give him something to eat and drink. His name was Ri Chang-ho. He was 6 years older than me, tall and very handsome, like the soldier in the propaganda posters. In fact, most of the border guards were good-looking, chosen to represent our country to the foreigners on the Chinese side. Their songbun had to be from the loyal class. These young men were privileged, but they were often lonely and far from home. Chang-ho was good-natured. Military duty didn't suit him. He didn't like being ordered about, and was frequently assigned menial duties as punishment for something or other. When they were off duty, border guards had to remain on base, but he would slip out, and often came to our house. He was charming, but I sometimes found him a little simple. He once told me that as part of his training, he had been shown a documentary film about weaponry. "We have the most amazing weapons, Min Young." His voice was excited, like a little boy's. "We can beat South Korea, and the Yankees. I can't wait till we're at war. It'll be over in no time." I knew that I could trust Chang Ho. On a cold night, in spring the previous year when I was 16, I was returning home around midnight from a friend's house. It was late for a girl to be out alone. As I approached my house, I made out his silhouette sitting at the side of the road. "What are you doing there?" I was surprised. "I've been waiting," he said.
"What for?"
"For you. I was worried." He was like the big brother I never had. I was too naive to recognize his interest in me. He took a letter from his coat and asked me to deliver it to his mother in Hamhung. He knew I was about to make a train journey there to visit Aunt Pretty. "Don't open it," he said, with an odd private smile. In Hamhung, I found the address and delivered the letter to his mother, and she read it in front of me. She, too, gave me an odd smile.
"Do you know what it says?"
she asked. He said it was private. She seemed to find this amusing and treated me very affectionately, giving me snacks and juice bought from a dollar store. She was an attractive woman. I could see where Chang Ho got his looks. When I got back to Haesan, Chang Ho told me with a broad smile what he'd written in the letter.
"Mother, I wish to marry this girl, so please treat her well."
I had not seen that coming. I glared at him in shock, and his face fell. "I'm too young to marry," I said flatly, taking a step back from him. I felt immediately sorry for him. It was a declaration of love I could have handled a lot more sensitively. To his great credit, he took the rebuff in his stride, which made me like him even more. We remained friends, and he continued dropping by the house. He was still patrolling the border the following year as I plotted my sneak visit to China. By now, my school friend had given up waiting for me to convince my mother, and had gone across on her own. This had disappointed me, but it made me more determined than ever to go, even if it meant going alone. The more I thought about it, the more daring my plan became. Why slip across just for a few hours? Why not visit my father's relatives in Shenyang? It was a longer journey, but perhaps Mr. An or Mr. Chang would take me. I'd still be back home within 4 or 5 days. I decided I'd ask Mr. An. He was friendlier than Mr. Chang. I started preparing the way. I told Min Young that if I didn't come home one evening, it was because I crossed the border to visit Mr. An and his wife. We could see their small house among the trees in Chiang Bai from our riverbank. Mino went quiet when I said this. I could see he wasn't happy with the idea. He was 10 years old now, almost old enough to feel protective of me. The date I chose was in the second week of December. I was resolved to leave after dinner. There was little I could take. I had no Chinese currency, and I could hardly let my mother see me leave the house with a bag of spare clothes. That evening, my mother was cooking an unusually elaborate meal. "Why have you made so much food?" I said. She had prepared much more than we normally ate. The kitchen was warm and smelled wonderful, of spicy stew and marinated pan-fried meat. She had even made bread in the steam pot. Her back was towards me as she stirred the pan. "I just want to give you both a nice meal," she said simply. My heart missed a beat. I don't think she guessed what I was about to do, yet it felt like a farewell supper. That evening I ate as much as I could. After the bowls were cleared, I put on my coat, as if it had just occurred to me to go out.
Where are you going at this time? She asked.
Just to a friend's house, I said, without looking at her. I'll be back in a few hours.
She put on her own coat and walked me out to the front gate, holding a kerosene lamp.
Don't stay out long. Come home quickly.
She smiled at me. Over the years to come, I could never shake the memory of that moment and the look on her face in the glow of the lamp. I saw love in her eyes. Her face showed complete trust in me. I turned away guiltily. I heard the gate clang shut behind me. This is it. My heart began to pound. It was a clear night, and so cold the air burnt my nose and turned my breath to plumes of vapour. I tightened my scarf and zipped my padded coat up to my chin. I stood still for a moment and listened. Dead silence. Not even a breeze to stir the trees. There was no one about. I looked up, and the vault of the sky was lit with stars. I began to walk. My footsteps seemed very loud. Eventually, there, about 10 yards ahead, I could make out the figure of Chang Ho in his long coat, patrolling the riverbank with his rifle on his back. Luckily, he was alone. There was just enough light to see by. The river beside me was a winding road of ice, pale and translucent, as if it were absorbing the starlight. I called Chang Ho's name in a low voice. He turned and waved, and switched on his flashlight. Before he could say a word, I said, "I'm crossing over to visit my relatives." I saw his eyebrows shoot up. I'd never mentioned relatives to him before. He thought about this, and shook his head slowly.
"No," he said dubiously.
"Too dangerous." His mouth turned down with concern.
"You could get into big trouble."
"Then how will you get to where your relatives live? You don't speak Chinese. And you're alone." "I know people just there who'll help." I nodded in the direction of Mr. Ahn's house. He stared at me for several seconds. It was as if he was seeing a different person.
"All right," he said slowly. "If you're sure..."
He was extremely reluctant about this.
"Don't be longer than a couple of hours."
"I'm hardly going to be long if I'm wearing these," I said, pointing to my feet. He shone his flashlight onto my expensive new shoes, gleaming in the beam. I'd worn them, thinking they would help me blend in on the other side. Suddenly we heard a twig snap underfoot on the other bank, and our heads turned. A dark outline of a figure was lurking on the other bank, obviously a Chinese smuggler waiting for a contact to exchange goods.
"Hey!" Chang Ho called over to him.
The figure looked as if he was about to run away, so he must have been surprised when Chang Ho's next words were,
"Would you help this lady across and take her to where she needs to go?"
There was a pause. Then a faint voice called back,
"Sure."
It was just a few slippery steps. I'd be across in under a minute. For the first time, I was scared. If any of the other guards saw me, they'd have no hesitation in dragging me back, even from the Chinese bank, where they were not supposed to tread. This was the first time I had ever done something so flagrantly, criminally illegal. I didn't feel guilt now, just a rushing, hair-raising danger. I stepped onto the ice. One foot, then the next, wobbling and sliding in the new shoes. Ahead of me, the Chinese stranger had emerged from the shadows of the trees to help me, holding out his arm. My mother would be fine, I told myself. Later tonight, Mino would tell her where I'd gone. By the time I returned, she'd have forgotten her anger. I'd only be away for a few days. I was so sure of this that I didn't even look back. So why did I get the feeling that my life was about to change forever? Part 2. To the Heart of the Dragon. Chapter 19. A Visit to Mr. Ahn.
The door opened, casting a wedge of yellow light across the frozen ground.
"Good evening, Mr. Arne," I said, bowing my head. Mr. Arne's tall figure filled the doorway. He frowned. It took him a moment to recognize me.
"Hello there."
He was most surprised. "Min Young, isn't it?" My teeth were chattering now, and I was regretting my fashionable new shoes. My toes were already swollen and numb. He invited me in. He was a large man, with a few strands of hair ribbed across the top of a bald head, and enormous bulging eyes. "A face like a jolly fat fish," was Minho's joke. My mother knew him through connections of my father's among the border guards. They said he was the nicest and most trustworthy of the Chinese traders. I much preferred him to Mr. Chang, his grouchy next-door neighbour, my mother's other occasional business partner. The interior of Mr. Arne's house was warm and inviting. He and his wife lived with their daughter, who was my age, and their son, who was Mino's age. They were Korean-Chinese, and their accent more sing-song than mine. Seeing them together around the low table on the floor, I knew this was a close-knit, loving family. Mrs. Arne was very small and slight compared with her husband, with quick, nervous movements, like a bird's. After she'd given me hot tea, and they'd asked about Mino, whom they liked very much, they looked at me expectantly. What on earth was I doing here? I explained that I wanted to visit my relatives in Shenyang for a few days. "I was wondering if I could spend the night, and if you could help me get there tomorrow. I don't have any money. My relatives will pay you back." I lowered my eyes. I had not thought this through. It had been years since I'd seen my relatives from Shenyang. I felt my face redden. "Or, if they don't, my mother will, when I get back." Mr. Arne frowned again and scratched the back of his neck. He must have known then that I didn't have a clue what I was doing. After a while, he said, "Do you know how far it is to Shenyang?" I had only the vaguest notion of this city. I thought it was nearby, maybe an hour away on the bus. "It's an 8-hour journey," he said, watching his words sink in. "And the bus is dangerous because you don't have ID and you don't speak Mandarin. There's a police checkpoint along the way." This was another serious matter I had not fully considered. The possibility of getting caught. Any North Koreans found illegally in China were handed over to the Puibu. "It's all right." The stricken look on my face amused him. "I can take you, if you really want to go. But we'll have to get there in a taxi." I realize now what an extraordinary imposition I was making on him and what a kindness he was doing me. I thanked him, but he held up his palm. He'd been trading with my mother for years, he said. He valued her custom and trusted her. In the morning, after we'd eaten breakfast, Mrs. Arne began cooking a huge pot of ndunji. This is the rice at the bottom of the pot that gets a little burned and is crisp on the outside.
"I make this for the North Korean visitors," she said. "They stop by here at night. Some of them we know. Others are strangers. It happens all the time. If I make this, it's easy just to add some water and heat it up."
She told me about two strangers who had knocked on the door a year ago. They were emaciated and very weak. They ate a whole potful, enough for 20 people.
"It was awful to watch. They were like wild animals afraid the food would be taken from them. I knew they were eating too quickly. They had to rush outside and puke it all up."
I could see that the Arnes were not rich. Their home was not like the ones I had seen in the Chinese TV dramas. They had no servants, or a microwave, or a bathroom with gold taps. In fact, it wasn't as nice as our house. But they had plenty of food. That morning, Mr. Arne showed me Chiang Bai. It felt most odd to be walking among buildings I'd been seeing all my life from the other side of the river, as if I'd passed through a mirror. It was a small town, with pharmacies, window displays filled with ladies' shoes of many styles, cosmetics shops, and food everywhere. In cheap canteens, in supermarkets, in colourful packages displayed in kiosks, in the hands of schoolkids with spiky hair, eating in the street. Mr. An gave me cash to buy some warm winter half boots and a light green Chinese-style padded winter coat. These would make me look more Chinese. I had already cut my hair in the style that was fashionable then for girls in China, like men's, long at the front and short at the back. The next morning we set off as the sky was lightening. Mr. An sat next to me in the back of a new taxi car. This in itself was a thrill. I had seldom been in a civilian car. This one had a sound system for the radio. The road ran for a short distance along the river, the border itself. I could not take my eyes from the view of Heysan. It had snowed heavily overnight, giving the houses domed roofs, like white mushrooms. I could see the victorious Battle of Pochombo Memorial in the park, its statues wearing wigs of ice, and my elementary school. The city seemed lost in time. Every building was weathered and grey. Only the snow-clad mountains in the background looked new, brilliant against the neon-blue tint of the dawn. Two North Korean guards in long coats were patrolling the path far along the bank, watching the women, padded and muffled against the cold, who had climbed down to the river and made holes in the ice to fill their pails. Rabbit fur for the soldiers who keep us safe, scrap iron for their guns, copper for their bullets. Behind them, hundreds of squat houses poured yontan smoke from stovepipe chimneys, creating a low haze. Through the trees I caught a glimpse, just for a second, of my house with its tall white wall. The gates were shut. It made me wistful. I'll be back soon. At the same time, I was feeling a mounting elation, like bubbles rising in my chest, a sense of freedom and anticipation, that now I could do anything. In the darkness at the edge of the ice, I had taken a terrible risk. But now look where I was. I had done it. I felt brave and proud. For a few minutes, the snow everywhere seemed to blanket and silence the doubts in my head. But soon, an internal self-criticism was in session. I noticed that Comrade Min-Yun is feeling happy. I would like to remind her that she doesn't have the first idea about what's going to happen next. Then I had a vision of my mother's face, of the love and trust in her eyes as she said, "Don't stay out late," and pictured her scolding Min-ho for not having told her earlier where I'd gone. My thoughts became less elated. I felt pangs of guilt and selfishness and stupidity. I'll be back soon. The road curved to the right. The trees became thicker. And Heysan disappeared from view. Chapter 20. Home Truths. The road twisted and turned through the Changbai Mountains. We passed sparse villages of squat, tile-roofed houses along the way. They didn't look much different from those in North Korea. But after a few hours' distance, the villages were larger and looked more prosperous. Gradually they merged into towns, and the towns into suburbs. The two-lane road became four lanes. Soon the traffic was a broad, slow-moving river of steel and glowing red taillights. We were caught in an ant-like crawl of thousands of cars, more than I had ever seen. Far from being bored, my eyes were everywhere taking this in. Every vehicle looked new. There were none of the heavy green military trucks, the most common vehicles around Heysan. We stopped for lunch at a service station at the side of the freeway, which had photographs of mouth-watering dishes displayed in illuminated signs. In North Korea, there were only state-owned restaurants, which saw no reason or need to entice customers or make any effort to sell, and private, semi-legal ones operating furtively in markets or in people's homes. But here, the restaurants were advertising themselves brightly, inviting me to stop and look. I ordered egg-fried rice, and the waitress brought a huge plateful. Chinese people eat so much.
I looked up at Mr. Ahn. He laughed heartedly at my expression. He was enjoying my reactions to everything. We approached Shenyang in the late afternoon along an 8-lane expressway. Nothing had prepared me for my first sight of the city. Huge towers of steel and glass rose on either side, their tips aflame in the last light of the sun. The taxi stopped at a crossing as the lights turned red, and hundreds of people crossed the road. Every one of them was dressed differently. No one was in uniform. I glanced up and saw a soaring billboard of an underwear model. I had not known that Shenyang, the capital of Liaoning province, is one of the largest cities in China. More than 8 million people live there. It made Pyongyang look like a provincial backwater. We reached the neighborhood where my relatives lived, and after stopping several times to ask for directions, found the address. It was in a large, glitzy apartment complex. Each block was 20 stories high. Mr. Ahn and the taxi driver came with me in the elevator up to the 11th floor. I rang the doorbell and felt a flutter of anxiety. I had no idea what to expect. My Uncle Junggi opened the door and looked from me to Mr. Ahn to the taxi driver. "Uncle, it's me, Minyoung." It took him a second to absorb this, and then his face was agog, like a cartoon character. Aunt Sanghee joined him at the door. She was as astonished as he was. My uncle was in fact my father's cousin. His family had fled Heisan during the Korean War, and he had grown up in Shenyang. He had visited us in Heisan twice, but not for several years. He had seemed wealthy to us, a little plump, very outgoing, and always laden with gifts. He was now in his late 40s. I introduced Mr. Ahn and explained that it was my vacation and I wanted to see China before I started college. My uncle paid the enormous taxi fare, and the driver left. After chatting for a while, Mr. Ahn said that he was going to do some shopping and return to Changbai. We said our goodbyes. My uncle and aunt made me feel instantly welcome. I was family. It made no difference to them that they had not seen me in years. Their apartment was modern and spacious, with small elegant spotlights set into the ceiling. This was like the homes I'd seen in the TV dramas. Floor-to-ceiling windows gave sweeping views onto a dozen tall apartment buildings identical to theirs. The sky had turned a deep orange. Lights were coming on in the other towers, making them look like jewel boxes. Beyond them, all the way to the horizon, hundreds more towers glittering in the dusk were being built or had been newly completed. My uncle asked my aunt to pop out and buy some ice cream. She came back with every variety she could find. "Try these," she said. "Some of them are new." We opened them all and I took a spoonful from each. They were the most heavenly flavors I had ever tasted. Jasmine flavor, green tea, mango, black sesame, a luscious fuchsia variety called taro, and a Japanese one called red bean. Red bean? Flavors I had not imagined possible. Oh, how this made me want to stay in China. My uncle was tall and slimmer than I remembered him. As a girl, I thought he looked plump because I had grown up in a country where there were no fat people. But compared with the large and rounded Chinese people I'd been seeing everywhere, I saw that his face had the boniness of someone who had endured decades of hardship. Wealth, for him, had come late in life. I had been so caught up in describing my journey and enjoying the ice cream that we had not yet got onto the subject of family. My uncle asked after my father. The spoon stopped halfway to my mouth. He did not know that my father, his cousin, was dead. When I explained what had happened, my uncle's mood darkened. "How dare they do that to him?" he muttered. He pressed me for details. He wanted to know everything about my father's arrest, the charges, the interrogation. I didn't want to talk about this. When I'd finished, he brooded in silence for several minutes. Then, to my great surprise, he stood up,
and launched into a tirade against my country. Years of bottled resentment were suddenly on his lips.
You know all the history they teach you at school is a lie.
This was his opening shot. He started counting off the fallacies he said I'd been taught. He said that at the end of the Second World War, the Japanese had not been defeated by Kim Il-sung's military genius. They'd been driven out by the Soviet Red Army, which had installed Kim Il-sung in power. There had been no revolution. I had never before heard my country being criticised. I thought he'd gone crazy.
When they taught you the South started the Korean War, didn't they? Well, here's some news for you. It was the North that invaded the South, and Kim Il-sung would have lost badly to the Yankees if China hadn't stepped in to save his arse.
Now I knew he'd gone crazy.
Were you shown the little wooden cabin on Mount Paektu where Kim Jong-il was born?
His tone was heavy with sarcasm.
It's a complete myth. He wasn't even born in Korea. He was born in Siberia, where his father was serving with the Red Army.
He could see from my face I did not believe a word of this. He might as well have been telling me the earth was flat.
He's not even a communist!
My uncle had worked himself up into a rage.
He lives in palaces and beach condos with brigades of pleasure girls. He drinks fine cognacs and eats Swiss cheeses, while his people go hungry. His only belief is in power.
This rant was making me uncomfortable. At home, we never mentioned the personal lives of the leaders. Ever. Any such talk was gossip, and highly dangerous. But my uncle was far from finished. He was pacing the room now.
"Do you know how Kim Il-sung died?"
he said, pointing at me.
"A heart attack." "That's right, and his son drove him to it."
I looked to Aunt Sang-hee for help, but her expression was as serious as my uncle's.
"Kim Jong-il killed him. By the end of his life, his father was a powerless old man who'd been turned into a god. Kim Jong-il was running the country. His father had no influence left except in foreign affairs."
My uncle's theory was this. Just before Kim Il-sung died, former US President Jimmy Carter had visited him to open the way for a summit with sitting US President Bill Clinton. As his legacy to Korea, Kim Il-sung was willing to make the peninsula nuclear-free and told Carter that North Korea would give up its nuclear weapons program. This incensed Kim Jong-il, who set about blocking the summit. The two had a blazing row. Kim Il-sung got so worked up that his heart failed. I refused to believe this nonsense, but at the same time parts of it rang true. I'd heard rumours at school that beautiful girls were selected for the dear leader's pleasure, and I'd seen for myself on the television news that he hadn't been fasting on simple meals of rice balls during the famine as the propaganda claimed. In truth, I didn't know what to think. And so a shutter came down in my mind. My response, as a 17-year-old girl, was to enjoy the ice cream. What my uncle said about my country had a depressing and repelling effect on me. I did not want to know. Uncle Jung-gi ran a trading company. He had started off by selling pharmaceuticals to South Korea, but his business had diversified and prospered. He drove a new Audi. Aunt Sang-hee was a pharmacist. They had a grown-up son who lived in another province. Both of them were talkative.